I want to thank the group for that. There certainly was no need for it, but I sure like it. I used to get other kinds of plaques, but that's a whole different story, you know. A woman asked me just before the meeting, you know, she says, do you get nervous? And I said, of course I do. I said, you know, I'm not a professional at this, and after I made that remark, I recalled an incident that happened at the University of Illinois some years ago. I was participating in an activity there at Huff Gymnasium at the University of Illinois on alcoholism, and I was a speaker on the program. And I was pretty new to AA and still hip, slick, and cool, and cocky, and all of that shit. And I was supposed to speak, I think it was about 8 o'clock on a Saturday night, and they had everybody who was in the program backstage and all of that. And so as I was walking around, they were showing me where I had to sit and where you had to go stand up when you come time to speak. And they had one of these little peek holes in the curtain so that you could open it up and you could look out into this big gymnasium, you know, and see who's there. And now, I had never spoken before a crowd of people, I don't think, bigger than 100 at that time. And I looked out into Huff Gymnasium, and I know from basketball experience that it seats 16,000 people. And it didn't look like there was an empty seat in that auditorium that night. So I really got shook up, but I didn't want anybody to know that. And about 10 minutes after I had looked out there, you know, I was standing around, and a woman came up to me just like tonight. And she said, are you the speaker? And I said, yes, oh, yeah. And I tried to look, you know, like Chuck Chamberlain or Clancy, as though it didn't bother me one bit. And she says, you're all the way from California? I said, oh, yeah, but that's nothing, you know. And she says, I bet you you're nervous. And I didn't want to let her know I was a newcomer. And I said, no, hell, I'm used to this kind of stuff. She says, you're not nervous at all? And I says, no. She says, then what are you doing in the ladies' room? And so that's about tells you how it is with me, you know. I'm going to talk about a subject tonight that I have to make a little opening remark before I get into it. Because I don't want to say anything tonight that will offend anybody. And please bear with me when I talk tonight, because I'm going to tell you exactly how it was with me. In no way am I trying to defame or blasphemize any kind of formal religion or your concept of a God as you understand him. I know that there are members of the clergy in the audience here tonight, and I certainly am not trying to offend you. I'm bound by a moral obligation to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous to tell you exactly how it was with me. And that's exactly what I intend to do. Now, I'm born and raised a Roman Catholic. It says I'm a Roman Catholic on my birth certificate. I was educated for the first 8 years of my formal education in a parochial school system. And I was taught about God by a loving mother and a father long before I ever went to school. I have never in my life had any kind of a doubt in the existence of a God. Now, many times people approach me and they ask me what I consider the most important part of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, usually people who are searching for the most important part of the program are people who are trying to become instant old-timers. They're trying to skip everything else and get right to the button. Well, I believe the entire program is important, that as a whole unit, it will work. Scattered and taken in little bits and pieces, I don't believe it would ever hold together. But, you know, if you had to single out the most important part of this program, it wouldn't be difficult, because it tells us in the book Alcoholics Anonymous what is the most important part of this program. Without any kind of doubt, it tells us that. Now, for years, I used to think sponsorship was, and I mentioned that last week, because sponsorship was the heart of the AA approach to recovery. But, you know, In the three pertinent facts that are read at the portion of the fifth chapter that we open most of our meetings with, the second and third of those three facts make the closest thing to a guarantee in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. It says that we believe that no human power could relieve our alcoholism. Now bear in mind who wrote those words. See, men and women just like you and I wrote those words. The founding members of Alcoholics Anonymous, who numbered amongst them non-believers, atheists, agnostics, and true believers and devout. But they were in full accord where they wrote that book. So it was their combined thinking that no human power could relieve our alcoholism. Well, that meant that Bill Wilson couldn't do it. Dr. Bob couldn't do it. Sponsor couldn't do it. You, the members of the group, couldn't do it. And even I, as a mortal human being, could not do it. Then pray tell, you know. If no human power can relieve my alcoholism, then who could? And in the very next, in the third of the three pertinent ideas, they tell us, in no uncertain terms, God could and would if he was sought. Now, that wasn't the Pope saying that. That wasn't the local parish priest or the minister down on the corner. That was a group of men and women just like you and I, who by their experiences, which was about 2 years prior to writing the book, by their experiences, it qualified them to say that God could and would if he was sought. Now, you'd think that just knowing about God, not denying God's existence, would have made that kind of acceptance easy for me. But it didn't, and I'm not unique. You see, I have never had any trouble accepting a God. Where I had my trouble was accepting the fact that this God had this power. Because as a small child, growing up in a Roman Catholic church, in an Italian neighborhood, in a religious, spiritually oriented home, God to me was represented by statues. What I saw, what was supposed to have been God, were holy ornaments scattered around our home and very obviously displayed in Our Lady of Victory Church, the church of my early religious training. Now, as a small boy going to Our Lady of Victory Church in New York City or just outside of New York City, I was in a predominantly Italian neighborhood, what they called Little Italy, for that matter. And as a little boy going to the parochial school system, many of you who have been students at a parochial school system know the formula well. Every morning it was 8 o'clock Mass up in the front four rows of the church, half an hour Mass, and then on into school. I was one of them guys that you see up in them front rows at every 8 o'clock Mass, with the nuns sitting behind them, hitting them with the stick. Kneel right, stand up, sit down, put away the baseball card, stop gazing, stop talking, put the gum out, bang, bang, bang. That's all it was, you know. That was my introduction, really, to religion. Now, I can remember trying to hold some kind of interest in church. I used the baseball cards for that. But on times when I couldn't look at the baseball cards, I used to look at the statues. And I used to wonder, you know, why people put so much faith in statues. And I'd wonder how people, who apparently seem to be adults, could actually believe that these statues could do something for them. And in my immaturity, I thought that was odd, you know. And there were a lot of mysteries in church for me when I was a little kid. You know, being in an Italian neighborhood, and I don't say this to be smart or funny or vulgar, Italian women have to be the greatest mourners in the world. Really, honest. Maybe not so much anymore, but in the old days, I can remember that no sooner was there a death in the family than, bang, out came the black. Everything was black. Them veils, the hats, the socks, you know, and the shoes and the purse. And it seemed like they never took that black off. And I can remember kneeling there early in the morning, right up front, watching the Italian women come into the church and go down them side aisles. I had never been down them side aisles. I wasn't allowed to go down them side aisles. We marched in the middle and went out in the middle, and that was it. And the dark aisles on the side were sort of dark and unknown, you know. And I used to wonder, what the hell do they do over there, you know? Because they'd go all the way down the aisle, and then they'd sort of almost disappear off into a corner someplace. And I couldn't really see them too good, but I could hear them over there, you know. And they'd sort of be mumbling and crying at the same time, talking to statues, you know. You know, never did I realize, and hell, I'm talking about over 50 years ago, that I'd be in San Jose, California in 1983 telling you about this. But one thing that I always remembered about them Italian women, when they came into church, I watched them. But when they came out, instead of going back down them aisles, they walked up to the center of the church. And then they knelt and turned around and went out the center aisle, right past me. And I'd be in that pew like this, you know, looking at them. And the thing that I remember was that they always looked better when they came out than they went in. And I wondered, what the hell did they do? You know, I knew that something in that corner changed these people. Now, I never realized that there was going to come a time in my life when all of this would come face to face with me. I never thought that I'd have to go into such depth to reaffiliate myself with the belief of a power greater than myself. But it came. It came in my life just as it came in yours. Because as some of you know, it took me 6 years to get my first full year of sobriety. I came here at age 24 and I made all of the mistakes. I had all of the insane ideas and notions that losers have, you know. There was no way I could be an alcoholic at 24, I thought, you know. And I thought I was working this program. I was trying. Hell, I knew them steps. I was one of them guys that could recite the fifth chapter without opening the book, you know. Thought that was cute, you know. So my sponsor cautioned me about that. Let me tell you what my sponsor thinks about people who recite the fifth chapter or quote the book without looking at it. He said, if you keep quoting it, you're going to forget to open it up. And the day you forget to open up that book, you're getting ready to drink. And I never forgot that. I never forgot that. So I don't try to memorize 10 and 12 pages at a time, you know. I might forget to open up the book then. But as a result of what the book refers to as a persistence in an illusion, you know, I wound up at that point that I had to wind up at, you know. You wound up at yours and I wound up at mine. That moment when we faced that dilemma that I believe they talked about here a few weeks ago. And if I didn't, that dilemma is that time, you know, that precedes a decision. You face a dilemma prior to making a decision as to whether to surrender and reach out for the help or to go on your own insane course. Now, that dilemma comes when you still have a spark of honesty left in your gut and you can bring it to the surface and recognize yourself at that moment for what you've become and what you are. And that usually hurts. And mine came, you know, in a Skid Row saloon, you know, called Rothschild's on West Madison Street in Chicago, Illinois, you know. And place where I had generated down to nothing more than a scum, you know, a cancerous thing, just biding his time and taking up space, you know. And one morning as I stood or sat or crawled or laid or knelt or whatever way I was in to drink, in that saloon I looked at my drink. And I knew that it was killing me. I knew that. You knew it too. That's when you look at that drink and you say, if I drink that son of a bitch, it's going to kill me. And then in the back of your head, something saying, but if you don't drink it, you're going to die. And that's a dilemma. If I drink it, I die. If I don't drink it, I die. And you have to make a decision. And I went to the right guy, thank God, or God directed me to the right guy. Because when I told him of my insanity and my difficulties with this program, he said, you've done everything right, except turn yourself over to a power greater than yourself. You've got to reaffirm some kind of faith in God, Duff. And I said, I can't do that because I don't believe in this power. I don't believe in statues. I don't believe in all of these miracles that you talk about. They're nothing but coincidences. And then he set me on a course. He said, have you ever had any coincidences in your life? And I was quick to say, of course not. I said, oh, wait a minute. And he says, tell me about it. And I said, well, this wouldn't interest you. I said, it's just one of them things that happened. He says, tell me about it. And I said, well, when I was about 7 years old, my brother came sick with double pneumonia and streptococcus, which is in the days prior to the antibiotics, and so it was almost fatal. Very serious illness in those days. And we were poor and we were on relief, which was the welfare of our time. So there was no room at the hospital for my brother. Instead, the city gave mother a hospital bed that she put up in the parlor. Sometime during the week, a city or a county nurse stopped by and done a few things, and a doctor came by once a week or whenever, I don't really know. I was just a little kid, just a little kid. But one night I heard that doctor telling my mother that my brother was going to die that night. That they had done all they could for my brother. But due to the nature of his illnesses and the seriousness of it, he certainly would expire that night or surely before the week was out. I wish I could get cornball and say I got sad and cried, and I didn't. I was just too young to know about death, I guess. And nothing changed the next morning when Mama got me up to go send me off to school again. I left the house at 7:30 like I had left it every other morning. Didn't bother to look in on my brother or even think of my brother. And off I went to school doing the little things that little bastards like me do on the way to school, you know. I used to steal pennies off of the newsstands out in front of the candy stores. Because that's the only way a kid like me would ever get a hold of any candy, was by stealing them pennies. And that particular morning, I guess I stole 5 pennies, and I went on up to church and school, went up there in the front row, looked at my baseball cards, got a couple of whacks from the nuns, watched the Italian women come down the aisles, wondered what went on the hell in the corner, and then went off to school. That afternoon, I got out of school about 3:15, and started to walk down the hill, got to the corner where I had to cross over. Mr. Schaefer, the cop, was standing there, and I was waiting for him to give me the signal across the street, but all of a sudden, bang, it hit me. The reality of death. Good God, my brother might be dead. And I began to magnify my thoughts, and I could imagine my brother already being buried. I was afraid I'd never see my brother again, not even in death. And I began to cry and sob and weep hysterically, I guess. Then all of a sudden I thought of the Italian women. I thought of that side of the church where I'd never been. I thought of that corner. Wondered what the hell went on down there. So I turned around and said across the street, I went into the church. And it took all the courage that I had at age 7 Because full of fear, I walked over to the side of the church that I'd never been in my life. And I walked down that dark side of the church into that corner. When I got down into that corner, I noticed there was a lot of more statues there. There was a thing there with a whole lot of candles in it. There was a place to kneel. Now, I knew about praying. I had taught about praying. I knew how to kneel, and I had a respect for God as I understood Him then, so I knelt. I knelt in front of them statues. Now, I have no idea in the world what the hell I said. No idea. I'd be a blasphemous liar if I told you I could remember what I said at age 7. But I know what I didn't say. I know at that very moment, full of all of them fears, full of all that hysteria, that I didn't recite any of those things that them nuns had taught me, that every kid that ever gone through that school knew by heart, them things that you could rattle off just like that and didn't mean nothing. I know I didn't say that. I'm quite sure I talked to somebody, whether it was a statue or whether it was just the space. I know that I talked to somebody. And I talked not from the mouth, but from the gut and from the heart. And my talk was a plea for my brother. Now, my brother is still alive. My brother lives in Yonkers, New York. Just retired from the Longshoremen's Union in New York. Very healthy. I wouldn't be that self-centered to think that my prayers are the reason that my brother's alive. I'm quite sure my late mother prayed a lot more and a lot more sincerity than I prayed. The fact is that he lived. And as I told this to this man, you know, I still associated it with a coincidence. And he smiled that smirk, you know, that only them old-timers in AA have, you know, when they sort of know they got you, you know. And he says, have there ever been any other coincidences in your life? And I said, no, that was the only one, so don't lay that trip. I said, well, wait a minute. I said, yeah, but this has nothing to do with that. He says, tell me about it. And I said, well, it was in that same school, that same church. Only it was a few years later now. I said, as a matter of fact, it was when I was graduating from the parochial school to go into the public school system, into the high school. I was going to eighth grade into the ninth grade. Now, for those of you who are not Roman Catholic, I'd have to explain something. Roman Catholics have a distorted conception of quality education. They believe that 8 years of a parochial school education is equivalent to a master's degree at Southern Methodist, you know. Now, when it came time to give out them report cards, I didn't get one. I was given a letter to take home. And the letter was informing my parents that I had failed to passed the course in English, and it was the consideration of the faculty at Our Lady of Victory School that I be held in the eighth grade for one more year because I wasn't prepared to enter into the public school system. Holy Toledo. You know, to have to face an Irish father with that kind of a letter, the only way he would interpret that would be in big black letters he would see, "You are too dumb to go to a public school." And he would be furious over that. I remember giving some thought to how old you had to be to join the Foreign Legion. I wondered if it hurt to burn to death. And could you really go to China by digging a hole in the ground? You know? These were all them childhood fears because my father was a strict taskmaster, very strict. God, I was scared. And it was the last day of school. We had to empty out the lockers. You remember that, you know? One sneaker, torn t-shirts, old sweatshirts, and busted notebooks, half-finished shelf from the wood shop, and taped up softball, all that good stuff, you know. And Mama had given me a nickel to take the trolley car home because she knew I'd be carrying all of this stuff. And I came out of school, you know, heavy-hearted boy and full of that fear, carrying all my stuff. And I got down to the corner and I was waiting for Mr. Schaefer to give me the signal to cross the street so I could go down the hill and get on the trolley car. And I was standing right in front of the church. And all of a sudden, I thought of the Italian women. I thought about my brother. I thought about a little thing that I had done when I had gone down in that corner to pray about my brother. This big brass thing had been there with all of these candles in it. And it had said offering 10 cents. And I had only had them 5 pennies that morning. So I rationalized that as a kid, I should get it for at least half price. So I took the 5 pennies, which meant a lot to me, and I put them in, and I did what every 7-year-old kid would do. I lit every candle that wasn't lit, you know. And so as I stood there once more in front of that church crying and full of fear, I turned from Mr. Schaefer and I walked into the vestibule of that church. And I laid my gear down on the floor and I went in and I turned to the left and I went down the aisle. The aisle's on the side. I went down to that corner. And again, I went up to where them candles were and I put the nickel in that Mother had given me for the trolley car and I lit every candle that wasn't lit. And again, I talked to somebody. Oh, how I talked to somebody. And again, I talked from my heart and from my gut, not from anything that I had ever been forced to memorize. Then I got up and I left. And I went down the hill and talked the streetcar conductor into letting me on the trolley because I told him I had lost my nickel. And he let me on. And the only empty seat on that trolley that day I had to share with a young man about 24 years old. Guy about 6'5". Big blonde guy. Big husky guy. Had on a light gray suit. I'll never forget that suit as long as I live. Because he was so big, he took up most of the seat. So I had to turn, you know, with my back to him, really, and my feet were out in the aisle of the trolley car. And I was holding all of my gear on a lap. And as the trolley trundled along, all of a sudden this stranger turned to me and he said, "Are you getting out of school for the summer?" I said, "That's right." And he said, "Boy, I'll bet you you're happy." And that was like pulling the dike, and out the tears came, and all of the fear and all the hysteria. And I poured it all out to this guy. I told him how scared I was of facing my father and how ashamed I was of the fact that I had failed. And he asked me what course I had failed, and I told him I'd failed English. And he said, "Didn't they tell you about summer school? Didn't they tell you that the public school system has a thing called summer school where you can go and forfeit your vacation? And for 8 weeks during the summer, you'll go to school. And if you pass at the end of the 8 weeks, then you'll get promoted on with the rest of your class." I said, "God, I don't know." I said, "How could I do it in 8 weeks if I haven't been able to do it in 16, you know?" And he said, "Well, you sound like you'd be willing to pay a little bit more attention now." And I said, "Oh, sure, I really would." And he said, "Would you put the baseball cards away?" I said, "Oh, yeah, I wouldn't even bring them to school." And he said, "I'd stop looking out the window." And I said, "Do all of the things he said." And I said, "You really think I could do that?" And he sort of smiled. And he said, "I think you could." And he said, "Are you sure you'd do what the teacher told you to do?" And I said, "Oh, God, I'd do what the teacher told me to do." The guy who sat alongside of me that day retired 3 years ago as superintendent of schools in Mount Vernon, New York. His name was Hamilton B. Ryder. The day he sat alongside of me on that streetcar, he was a young student teacher assigned to teach English for the summer school session. You know, Mr. Ryder has heard me tell this talk. I've told this a few times when I've participated in programs in the East, you know. And it makes him cry every time I tell him that, you know. And it almost makes me cry because we grew to be great friends as a result of that. And we grew to become more than a student and a teacher relationship. He corresponded with me all during my ordeal in the war, and somehow his mail always got to me, and the things he said were the things that you know helped me get through, and all during my troubles and my alcoholism, this guy always was there whenever I needed some kind of good advice. So he was a very important man in my life. And God sat him alongside of me that day on that streetcar. That I have no doubt about. So that sort of began to make me in earnest believe that, come on, these things called coincidences are more than that. That this God, this power must exist. But you know, we know so well of the self-centeredness of the alcoholic, you know. We're cautioned about it in our book. Where it says this self-centeredness must be smashed. And still there walks amongst us many, many who are void of this belief in this power, who constantly demand proof and the existence of this power because of their egotistical nature. Now, we don't walk with proof. We don't carry proof. But experiences present proof. And it's the experiences that we share with each other that furnish the visual, vivid proof of this power. If you do as it says in that third fact, if it were sought, you have to seek out this proof, this evidence. It's in all of your lives. It has been since the day you were born. If you need any kind of motivation to start this chain of thought, first I ask any of you in here who happen to be combat veterans of our military forces in any of the wars, Nam, Korea, World War II, or whatever. Don't tell me for one damn minute that you don't believe in God. Because if you've never talked to God in Vietnam, Korea, or somewhere in the Pacific or in Europe, you weren't there. You weren't there. Easier than that. Please. By a show of your hands, how many of you gentlemen in here are fathers? You guys ever go someplace? Go bowling or anything? You want to be ashamed of yourself. Now, I don't know too many of you personally. Not that I wouldn't like to. Yeah. I want what you got. I'm going to tell you about a time you prayed. And I hope some of you who put up your hand are atheists and agnostics. I'll tell you about a time you prayed. Think for a moment where you were at that time that first child was about to be born. Your first child. If just taking your wife off into a delivery room, perhaps someplace, right? They're walking that floor. You might even be able to hear them screams, labor room. I wasn't even with you, but I'll tell you what you was talking about. You were saying things like this. Oh, God. Don't let anything happen to her, God, please. God, that's the most important thing in my life. God, I don't care whether it's a boy or a girl now. That's all crap. Just make it all right, God. That's all. I just want it to be all right, God. Make sure it has legs and arms and it can see, God. That's all I want. I don't want too much, God. Please, God. Now, only you who raised your hands know the outcome of that prayer. Only you who know that. So as I continued to search for the evidence, it became apparent to me that God could and would if he was sought. But how do you seek God? It says you seek God through prayer and through meditation. You mean I got to go talk to them statues? And I tried that. I tried talking to the statues. And I couldn't shake it. All they were statues. And I read, and I reread, and I talked, and I counseled, and I got counseled. I wanted to see God. And they told me that God's image is in everybody. In everybody. That made a little bit of sense. And I looked at you, sometimes weirdly, you know. Is this God? Or perhaps this one is God. Always searching for God. And then one night at an AA meeting, I found him. Yeah, I found him. You know, there was a time when we didn't hold hands when we closed AA meetings. We just stood up, bowed our heads, and held our hands in prayer together. That's exactly what I was doing one night when I said something that I had said numerous other times in AA, but it had never made any sense to me. I'd always said it the same way I had said them little ditties that the nuns had taught me. And that was it. But that night, as we stood there ready to close the meeting, my moment of clarity came. Because just as soon as we said, Our Father, I knew God. I knew the God as I had to understand Him. You see, I loved my Father more than anything I've ever loved in my life. My Father is the greatest, or was the greatest thing in my life. For his way of life. In the eyes of the state of New York, my father was a criminal. In the eyes of people like you and me, he was sort of a Robin Hood. But he paid a price. He paid a price. But Jesus, how I loved him. How I loved him. My father was about 6'4". And about 230 pounds, I guess. And every inch of him was a man. He was a tough son of a bitch. But he had a zest for living that, God, if I only had a touch of it. If I could just be that fraction of what my father was, I'd be complete. And he loved everybody and everything. And you know, he roared. He didn't talk and he didn't laugh. He roared. You could hear him for blocks when he laughed. He never wore a coat. He always just wore a vest and a derby. And I never heard him say anything bad about anybody. Even the courts. Even the district attorney, a guy by the name of Tom Dewey. Even said good things about him. The man who was to crush my father and his associates and the thing called Tammany Hall, you know. I can remember being with my father as a small kid. I never saw him much. Usually it was on Sunday morning, and I was the baby in our family. Perhaps my father's favorite. I don't know. But it was on Sunday mornings that he would take me with him. He wasn't much of a churchgoer either. He'd take me to the Elks Club. And I remember that so well. Because we'd have to walk right through Little Italy. Now, when you got a name like Duffy, and you're living in Little Italy, you got a lot of problems. A lot of them little dagos want a piece of your ass every day, you know. They usually got a bit of me every day, you know. But as that song goes, never on Sunday. I can remember my father's shirt, you know, he used to have black hair used to come out here. And I always used to be scared that he was going to crush me to it and rub all of that hair on me. And his arms were massive. And he'd hold my hand, and God, his hand was like a big boat, you know. And I'd just be in there like that as we'd walk through Little Italy. And he'd say hello to the guy in the produce store, hello to the guy in the bakery, and he'd holler at people sitting on the fire escapes on the steps of the stoops. He knew all the cops. It seemed like everybody loved my father. My mother, before she died, heard me say this a couple of times, and she says, Eugene, I think you over-exaggerate that sometimes, but maybe I did, but I'm only telling you about him as I remember him through a child's memories. And I can remember holding that hand and how safe I felt when I held that hand. And I'd see all them little guineas looking at me, you know. But none of them came near me as long as I held that hand. And I can remember talking to my father. My father knew everything. He knew why grass was green. He knew why butterflies were all different colors. There was nothing I couldn't ask him that he didn't know. I realize now he probably didn't know nothing. He was telling me all bullshit, but... But I didn't know that then. And as huge and as strong as he was so gentle. So gentle. Because I could remember one night we were sitting on the stoop in the summer and it was hot. And my brother had pigeons up on the roof in a little coop. He raised pigeons. And his best pigeon had gotten its wing caught in the chicken wire. I'm trying to get out, I guess. It had done something to its wing. And my brother came down the stairs, tearful and crying, you know, because his pigeon had a bad wing. And as I sat alongside of my father, my brother handed my father the pigeon. And it was like a nest. My father's hand was like a nest. And he fooled around with the pigeon, and he used some matches and a popsicle stick, and he... What the hell he did? And the pigeon just kept going... And he fixed the pigeon's wing, and he gave it back to my brother, and the pigeon went... like that. God, I'll never forget that. That's how I feel now, you know. When I talk to God, as I will tonight, and I will tomorrow morning, I talk to him as though I'm talking to my father. In no way am I trying to portray the image of my father as the image of God, but it's the image of my understanding. And I feel the strength of God as I feel the strength of my father. And holding God's hand is like holding my father's hand. And as it was then, it is now, that nothing can happen to me as long as I hold that hand. And I never lied to my father in my life. Not for any morality, more from fear. fear. And I've never had to lie to God. And God gives me answers too, just as my father did. But I don't believe God's answers now, God's directions, could be put in the same category as my father's malarkey. But the feeling is still there. And I'm comfortable with this God now because I think of the love I had for my father. And the love for my father is the same love that I have for God. My father was a hell of a guy and he taught me a million lessons. I've often said that I don't have an education, but that really isn't true. I don't have a formal education, no, not in them books. But I've been taught so many things by people, but more so by my father and my grandfather. You know, my father, as I said, was sort of a black sheep in a family. My grandfather, which would have been his father, him and Grandpa were at odds with each other because of my father's apparent chosen way of life. Everybody else in our family were stonemasons, including my father to a time. And then finally one day he thought the fields of Canada and coast of Cuba were more lucrative than fooling around building buildings, and so he went into bootlegging and things like that. But I can remember, you know, a time when he was working with my father, well, working with my uncles. I have to sort of give a little biographic sketch of this. We come from a very strong Irish family, sort of a leader of a larger group of Irish people was my grandfather and his family. Now, in those days, the early 30s and the late 20s, there was a lot of illegal activity taking place. Prohibition was around and gambling was, you know, they called them the Roaring 20s and those kind of things. There were three big criminal factions in the city of New York. There were the ever-present Italian gangs, the Jewish gangs, and of course, the Irish gangs, who were constantly at each other's throats, grabbing territories and situations. And our family was certainly involved in that. My Uncle Sarchi ran the biggest floating crap game in the East Coast, and he was gunned down in a taxi cab in Miami Beach, Florida, by the Jewish gangs. And in turn for that, one of my other uncles, my Uncle Tommy, killed a couple of Jewish men. And my father was involved in some things like that. But yet they were all still family. And I say this almost with a smirk. Because let me tell you how I learned about rationalization. The thing that us alcoholics shine at. When my Uncle Sarchi was laid out, you know, at the wake. Now, here was a man whom I had known, you know, by reading newspaper, had been responsible for the death of at least seven people. He had killed seven. I read it in the papers. Everybody knew that. When we went to the funeral home that night, in those days, the entire families were never in one group together. I went to the funeral home with my grandmother and my mother. My brother and my father and others went at a different time. But I can remember with my grandmother and my mother walking up to the casket to see this murderer. The first thing I noticed, there he was in a fourth degree Knights of Columbus suit, you know. The big sword and all of the rosary in his hand, you know. And you know what my grandmother said? She cried a little and she said, "Poor Sarchi, he was so good to the church. That made it all right. That made it all right. One decent act wipes out all of the crap. You and I have done that during our drinking careers. You give your kid a baseball glove at Christmas Eve, and that makes everything sweet for the year. You know. You send the wife one card on Mother's Day, and she's supposed to shut up for the other 51 weeks. You know. But we were working, you know, to show you the kind of a guy my father was and this family was. As I mentioned in one of my talks here, I was indentured into the construction trades very early, and we had to go as little kids and work around. Our first job, of course, was carrying water. We used to carry the water pails, you know, up and down to the bricklayers and the stonemasons. Now, my father was punishing me one Saturday for some reason. I don't ever know what it was, but the punishment was that as soon as we got through work, I was to go right home and stay home. I couldn't go to the show. And boy, that was a tragedy in my life. So I was stumbling around the scaffolding, banging the pails down and knocking the dippers over. And I came upon my grandfather and my Uncle Tim. And they were setting a big stone. And I put the water down by them and I kicked something. Now my Uncle Tim was about the closest thing to a parish priest as you'd ever find. He was a very gentle man, you know. And my grandfather was just the opposite. He was a kind of a guy that drank a half a pint when he woke up in the morning, you know, and said, then told the world to get the hell out of his way, you know. And so they knew that I was upset. So Grandpa said to me, he said, what are you upset about? So I told him how mad I was at my father. Now, these guys were great practical jokers. So my grandpa and my Uncle Tim, who I believed, you know, it was like talking to the Pope when I talked to my Uncle Tim, you know. Never would I doubt him. And they had this connive between them. And Grandpa said, well, no, your dad's not mad at you. He's putting you through the man test. I said, what the hell is the man test? And he says, well, today is the day that you have to prove that you're a man to your father. He says, and when you do that, he's going to let you go to the show. I said, oh, how do I do that? He says, you got to hit him. Now, do you know any little kids that doubt their grandfather, you know? And I said, how can I hit him? I said, I can't even reach him, you know. And I couldn't. And Uncle Tim says, that's why you have to hit him with a 2x4. Well, I understood that. And I said, but if he sees me coming at him with a 2x4, I won't be able to hit him. And Grandpa says, that's the idea. Don't let him see you. So he says, my father's specialty was ornamental plastering. You know, he used to put cold moldings in and little fancy things around in churches. He was very good at that when he felt like working. So he used to put the hot lime plaster together in one of the shanties. He had his own little shanty. And every now and then he'd have to go get 2 5-gallon pails full of this hot lime that he used in the plaster. And Grandpa says, you wait for your father to be coming out of the shanty. And he'll have a pail in each hand. And he says, you stand behind the door, but he steps out, you let him have it with the 2. And I believed that. And I stood behind the door there, and here come my father, you know, stripped to the waist, and handkerchief tied around his head. 2 5-gallon cans full of hot lime. God, they had to weigh 90 pounds each, I guess. And he come out, and just as he stepped out, I reached up and whack. Well, I hit him about here because I couldn't reach up there. And I can see him, hey, how I love you, Pop. You know? I can see him right now. He just smiled like them old-timers do in AA. And he didn't even spill any of the water out of it. And he just put him down like that. And Jesus Christ, he hit me and I didn't come down the ground for about 3 days. You know. And everybody laughed, you know. And as I rolled over to get up, you know, he said, if you don't cry, you go to the show. Boy, and I didn't cry. And that's how he taught me. That was the way he taught me. And I loved him. So God is easy for me. But you know, I know there are some skeptics in here yet. You know, that's all that Duffy and him bullshit, you know. But I'm going to put you in one hell of a spot. Yeah. I'm nothing but a guy who sold his blood to drink. I certainly am no authority. I don't represent any authority. But I'm going to give you the goddamnedest challenge you've ever had in your life. Tonight. If there sits anybody in here tonight that doubts the existence of this power, not of God, the power, I challenge you. Challenge you. I challenge you tonight. Go home, wherever you're going to go. And when that minute or that time comes tonight when you prepare to rest, please, just for tonight, whether you believe it or not, I want you to pray. And don't be scared of that word pray. That's just another word for talk. And we're masters at that. I want you to talk. Oh, and if you're scared of anybody seeing this obvious display of weakness, wait till you're all alone. Put out the lights. Hell, you don't even have to get down on your knees and do all of that kind of stuff. No, nobody know you're that weak. Hell, you could even smoke. And as you do it tonight, just for tonight, I'd like you to say this prayer. I'd like you to talk like this to God. But as you talk to God, please, if you can, imagine my feelings for my Father. And talk to whoever you think is your feeling. And say something like this. God, make tomorrow a better day for. Then you put in the name of anybody you choose. Anybody you choose. Preferably somebody whom you're going to be able to observe tomorrow. In other words, say, God, make tomorrow a better day for Joe. And put out your cigarette. Close your eyes. Go to sleep. Now, when you wake up tomorrow morning, you don't tell nobody who you prayed for tonight. You keep that between you and God. I challenge you. I challenge you to watch closely what takes place tomorrow in the life of the person whom you pray for tonight. Challenge you. If you need any evidence of that boast, answer this to yourself quietly and honestly. Can anyone sit in this room at this very moment deny that it's quite possible that you and I sit here tonight with some semblance of dignity? Because of the prayer of someone else. Thank you very much, Mark.